Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why do we sleep? What is its purpose? And what actually happens during sleep? But first, some call it a post-truth society. With increased media consolidation, fake news, and plummeting trust in media, what needs to be done to solve our epistemological crisis? With us are two experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. His latest book is called Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Victor Picard also joins us. He's a professor of communication at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Media Activism in the Digital Age. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you both back with us. Really important times for both of your areas of study, particularly now with media. I think we are in what, Victor, you have called a misinformation age, or you said society, but I would say misinformation age. I wonder if we should start, Victor, with your analysis of how we got here.
I think this situation we're in right now, which, as you noted, I characterize as a misinformation society, has happened gradually. There certainly have been historical reasons that led us to this current predicament. But I think what happened and why we're talking about it more now is that the election of Donald Trump brought into focus a number of structural pathologies in our media system. I think we're just now, as a society, beginning to reckon with some of these systemic problems, whether we're talking about the proliferation of so-called fake news or misinformation, as well as the tendencies for our mainstream news media system to sensationalize politics and important policy issues. So I think if there is a silver lining right now, at least more people are aware of these problems, and we're beginning to talk about potential structural ways to fix these problems.
You said it happened gradually, but your work suggests that there were a few major things that happened that led us down this path. What would you say those major things are?
Sure. I would pinpoint to two general areas. I would point out that what's sometimes referred to as the journalism crisis is a worsening problem where we are losing actual public service journalism. So in other words, there are fewer reporters covering important issues, things like elections and policy problems. So that's a supply problem where the news content is gradually being diminished. Then we also have more of an infrastructure problem where increasingly the actual pipes and channels and media flows are being controlled by fewer and fewer corporations. So this is a monopoly problem that, again, if I were to be cautiously optimistic, I think we're beginning to address this, at least at the discursive level. At least we're beginning to talk about this problem where media monopolies have too much power in society.
Bob Entman, do you agree with this assessment?
I guess I'd point out, in terms of what Victor was talking about, is change factors, that it's not just change in technology or change in markets, it's also a change in policy that's driven this. So the deregulation of the media, the almost complete abandonment of antitrust policy until, ironically, the Trump administration decided specifically to look into the acquisition of CNN is one factor. I also think, yes, we're beginning to talk about the problem of control, but the self-reinforcing power, smaller numbers of people and corporations together can influence the political process, makes it hard to do more than talk. And it remains to be seen whether pressure from below is going to be responded to in any way by the current government. It's possible with the change in government, we might see some differences. But I think we're talking about some structural changes actually in the way power flows, not just the way information flows.
So to me, it seems there are bigger problems in which the economic model fits into. I mean, I think we have bigger existential problems right now beyond the economic ownership. Part of this is, of course, I mean, there's a new trend of A, billionaires buying their own publications, which is counter to what we have historically seen, but there's also this proliferation of truly fake news. And I think combined with what we have been doing as media scholars in rightfully criticizing the economic model and rightfully criticizing the coverage of things, I fear that we have given a platform to somebody like Donald Trump to then be able to say it's all fake news whenever there's accuracy. Victor Picard, what do you think?
I do agree that the gradual weakening of our news media institutions have left them vulnerable to these kinds of exploitation. And to be a little more specific, I think the commercial imperatives that have been driving our news media for so long, but as they face economic crisis, in some ways these pressures have even worsened, has led them to sensationalize, has led them to gradually lose the public's trust. And it has become easier for opportunists like Donald Trump to step in and dismiss professional news media as being fake news. That is one problem. And I think you're also identifying another problem, that as these news organizations become weakened and devalued economically, they're easy pickings for politicos who have particular agendas to buy them up. And we're seeing that with newspapers, but we're also seeing that with further media conglomeration and media concentration. Exhibit A, I would point out, would be the rise of Sinclair Broadcast Group. They are in the process of merging with Tribune. If it goes through, they'll be reaching over 70% of American households. So these are just a couple of examples where, yes, I think the economic crisis have left news organizations vulnerable to these political opportunistic problems. And I agree with Bob, it's going to take policy intervention to change this.
Bob Entman, what about the handing of the platform to somebody like Donald Trump to then devalue what might be truly real as fake news? Have we contributed to that platform that he has?
Well, in the sense that the mainstream media, which, as Victor says, have suffered economic losses and confidence losses, they're now in a position where I think you have two real problems. One is the false equivalence, so that you had reporting during the 2016 campaign in which Trump's scandals were treated as actually less serious than Clinton's for a variety of technical reasons. But this equivalence traces to this marginalization, the fear of the mainstream media of these economic and trust issues. So you've got a weakness that has led them to abandon opportunities to correct a lot of these misimpressions from fake news. And actually, they could be increasing their own legitimacy if they did more reporting on the facts. Let me take a specific example. You turn CNN on at almost any hour, what they will be talking about is Donald Trump. And what they'll be talking about is the politics around Donald Trump and maybe the Russia scandal a little bit. But they won't be talking about very much about the policy issues, the policies that Donald Trump is making, the many forms of corruption that are on pretty clear view if you discuss it and point it out. And these are things that would make people, I think, both less susceptible to Trump's propaganda, which I think is very skillful. And I think he deserves actually more credit for being a skilled communicator than he gets. But it would delegitimize some of that and would give people more information on which to criticize and reject fake news.
I'm glad you brought up the scandal, because we have seen quite a bit of coverage on money laundering, what appears to be obstruction of justice, what appears to be a conspiracy. And you started to assess how the media have been covering these scandals. And it sounded like you gave them like a D. What would you say?
Well, I think they're doing a better job now than they did during the election campaign. So if you're talking about empowering Trump, you're really talking about his ability to manipulate the mainstream media as well as the digital media during the campaign to pay so much attention to Hillary Clinton's email so-called scandal and to distract attention from investigating his own. This combines, I should say, with another important factor in all of these crises, which is the change in the nature of our party system. The media rely heavily on the two parties and competition between the two parties. If one of those parties begins to abandon the norms that have governed the political process, you're really rendering the media less able to provide balanced coverage. An example of this abandoning the norm is and this is not about Donald Trump simply, but it's about things like the Republican National Committee and other prominent Republicans accepting Roy Moore and supporting Roy Moore as a candidate. This is an illustration of their leaving behind norms that used to govern political discourse and then enabled us to have a more balanced discussion of reality.
One of the other things that you've talked about, Bob Entman, and looking at media's coverage of important scandals versus not so important scandals or things that might not even really rise to the level of scandal, you've also talked about cover-up and using attacks on the media to essentially defend oneself. It seems like Donald Trump is doing that as well to discredit what might be true in a cover-up of the scandal. Are you analyzing this at this point too?
Yes, indeed, I am analyzing particularly the campaign. I guess I'd also point out that I think the media are pretty much doing quite a bit about the Trump scandals. However, what we have is a Congress that is really not interested in pursuing these. The whole story of Watergate and the whole enormous myth around Watergate and the great way that the system triumphed by getting rid of Nixon and his corruption was rooted in a system in which both Republicans and Democrats actually wanted to get to the bottom of the situation. We don't have that now. We don't have, for example, major hearings for television to be covering. And in the absence of that, you have a very different situation in the possibility that the cover-up could succeed, at least for a very long time. I think it's important for Americans and others around the world to recognize we're in a new political world, not just because of the media factors that Victor talked about, these political system factors.
So then, given the low trust in media and in government, and this, I guess the Economist called it a post-truth society, or what Victor is calling a misinformation society, and all of the other factors coming into this, the fake news sites, the billionaires buying up the media, net neutrality and what's happening to that. Is the toothpaste out of the tube or is this fixable? Victor Picard?
Well, I haven't given up hope that the problem is fixable or at least we can make it less of a problem. And I think the first step will be, again, to raise awareness around some of these issues and get people to think beyond the, you know, many of the factors that Bob was just discussing are kind of symptomatic characteristics in our news media. They're being driven by these commercial values. I mean, for example, the fact that they're so fixated on Donald Trump's latest tweet. I mean, that's irresistible for advertising-driven news media. That's inherently controversial. It drives ratings. And that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump is so ubiquitous in our news media. So I think if we start connecting these dots and show the structural reasons behind this kind of media content, we can begin to imagine a different kind of media system. And that's one where I think it needs to be less reliant on these market-based mechanisms. We have to start envisioning a more public-oriented media system, whether we're talking about protecting net neutrality or having a fully funded public media system. I think that's where the debate needs to go.
Well, I would generally agree with you. And the reason I asked if the toothpaste is out of the tube is because I don't see that happening in the U.S. And I see other countries following on the heels of the U.S. with this so-called liberalization of media, where even the BBC is struggling to, you know, continue its old path of this public service kind of broadcasting. And then you add to that all of the discrediting sites. The alt-right is creating their own web. We're speaking all different languages. We don't agree on basic realities. The fundamental purveyor of truth, which is science and scholarship, is getting thoroughly shredded in those other spheres. So, you know, I'm acting a little bit alarmist, perhaps, but I see this as a major existential crisis. Bob Entman, what do you think?
Well, when I look around the world, I do see it as a crisis. I do see liberal democratic institutions under assault by a lot of these forces we've talked about, as well as by opportunistic politicians and parties. I don't know whether to say I'm optimistic. I don't think that's right. But I also think, first of all, that Victor is absolutely right that there needs to be discussion of real public media and the value of that to democracy, the indispensable nature of that. But second of all, that there is hope in using the web and digital technologies to organize people, get people out to vote, to inform them to some degree. We saw in Bernie Sanders' campaign the use of the internet to organize and also to raise money that allowed him to mount a campaign that was pretty much the equal of Hillary Clinton's in financing. This is a very important lesson and model for going forward for future political organizing. So there are counter forces here.
Really important points, Bob Entman. So, Victor Picard, let's go back to you. One of the things that you've actually been writing about, too, is net neutrality. Walk us through what's at stake.
Yes. Well, I think it's very apt to turn to net neutrality, especially after Bob listed, I think, correctly, all of these democratic potentials that the internet holds, especially for activists in dissident groups and journalists as well. But we lose some of that democratic potential if we are to lose net neutrality protections. Net neutrality sounds very wonky and technical, but it's a very simple safeguard for the internet, which basically ensures that your internet service provider cannot censor political speech or just general expression online, that your internet service provider, whether it's Comcast or Verizon, cannot slow down or block online content, cannot create a tiered internet. And we've taken this for granted for many years. But if we were to lose net neutrality, it would radically change the basic logic of the internet. The struggle for net neutrality will not end at that moment, where I actually think activists have a good chance of winning it back. The regulatory agency cannot simply switch a rule every time a new administration comes into power. So I think there's reason that we may still prevail, but it's going to take a lot of struggle from below, as well as victory in the courts.
The other thing I'm really interested in hearing your take on, both of you, pertains to this idea of media literacy. Very sophisticated people, educated people are really distrusting fundamental facts because they have come from what we would call traditional media. What do you do to increase media literacy and the ability to discern the fake from the real in a general population? Victor, why don't you start?
Sure. I think whenever we talk about media literacy, there's often an assumption that this should be part of our educational curriculum, that it's something that we should be teaching in our schools. And I certainly agree with that. I also would go further to say that, and this speaks against some of the cynicism that I think rightfully is seeping into our conversation about the future of journalism. But right now, there is this newfound appreciation for the Fourth Estate. Many people are seeing it as an essential defense against everything from fake news to fascism. So I do think we are in an opportune moment to expand our media literacy efforts. And I think part of this, not to repeat myself, but I think part of this is to understand some of these structural relationships behind the news in order to understand why news covers issues in a particular way.
Bob Entman.
Absolutely. That the literacy, analytical thinking, appropriate skepticism without total distrust of science and scholarship and real journalism. All of these are things that we would like people to understand and look out for. We do have, unfortunately, elites in the United States, and I don't know about elsewhere, attacking public education and trying to weaken public education. We have a tax bill in which the graduate students of the United States are facing enormous increases in the cost of their education, which means teachers and professors are being attacked. So there are efforts to kind of undermine literacy of all forms. And I think that needs to be more on the table, that we really ought to be discussing how public education and education generally are under assault from a large component of our society. And, you know, if education's weakened, it's going to be harder to inculcate media literacy.
So just to bring a little cynicism back, Victor Picard, sorry.
Fine.
And what Bob Entman just talked about in terms of the what the Republicans have put forward on the tax bill, we've talked about the structural problems. We've said, look, we need a policy change. I don't see that happening with the current government. I didn't see it happening with a previous government or several previous ones before. What I'm wondering is, not saying that this can't change, but the current body in power thrives on this lack of education and the lack of literacy. Their power is based on this. So why would they give up any of it? And we are relying on grassroots to potentially challenge that. But I see a sort of clinging to power through these. Am I being conspiratorial?
I think you're being skeptical in a very healthy way. I think there is a healthy form of cynicism here at work. But I would also say that it is precisely during these dark political moments that we need to be thinking ahead. We need to be envisioning the kind of media system that we would want to have. What is our ideal vision for this? And right now, much of that project, you're absolutely right, is not something that we can take. We certainly wouldn't want the Trump administration to suddenly expand a kind of state media apparatus. On the other hand, I do think there are things that we could be doing at the local level. We could be supporting our local news organizations, even as individuals, but also as through community groups. We could be trying to create community-owned and municipal-owned and operated broadband networks. There are various local initiatives that are trying to take proceeds from spectrum auctions and fund local public service journalism initiatives. So there are things that we can be doing, but I think most important, we need to be thinking for the long term, for a post-Trump America, which I do think will happen someday.
Bob Entman, last word.
I think there are potential powerful counter reactions to what's happening now, and that all hope is not lost, as illustrated by what happened in Alabama. We have organizations like ProPublica that are doing terrific investigative work, and there's ways to get that material out through social media that didn't exist before. I like Victor's point about action at the local and state level. These are still places where ordinary citizens can have an impact on policy and things can change. I also think calling on a lot of the charitable organizations in the United States to turn a little, this may be controversial, turn a little of their attention away from the suffering in the rest of the world and come back home and spend some money on democracy and education right here in the United States.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us, Victor Picard and Robert Entman. Really a pleasure hosting you. I appreciate your thoughts and I appreciate your research, and I really appreciate you sharing them with us and our audience.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. His latest book is called Scandal and Silence: Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Victor Picard, he's a professor of communication at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Media Activism in the Digital Age. When we come back, why do we sleep? What is its purpose? And what actually happens during sleep? Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists are still trying to understand the mysteries of our slumber. With us are two experts who study the science of sleep. Marcos Frank is professor and chair at the Department of Biomedical Sciences at Washington State University, Spokane. He's the author of The Mystery of Sleep Function, The Role of Sleep in Memory Consolidation and Brain Plasticity, Dream or Reality. Graham Deering also joins us. He's a professor of cell biology and physiology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the co-author of Homer 1A Drives Homeostatic Scaling Down Excitatory Synapses During Sleep. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. I thought perhaps we should start with the very basics. What do we know about the purpose of sleep? Graham Deering, why don't you start us with what you have found?
Well, it's possibly a long answer, and I think we don't know the whole answer, but from my point of view, I've been focusing on learning and memory, and I think we can definitely say that sleep plays a very essential role in our ability to form memories and to continue to learn.
And how does that actually happen? What is the process in which sleep gives us this?
There are a few competing ideas, but one kind of emerging theme is that different parts of the brain are devoted to computing different types of information while we're awake. And it's only when you go offline, unconscious, that these different parts of the brain are actually able to stop what they're busy doing during the day and communicate with each other and consolidate memories. And you can imagine lots of memories might have many different kinds of components, visual components, emotional components, motor components. And it's really this time of sleep when all of these pieces can come together and form a memory that can be take a lasting form.
So there was something I read in your work, I think it was your work, about scaling down. What exactly is this?
So it started off from observations made from neurons in culture, that is lab-grown neurons in the dish. And under certain conditions, we observed that all of the synapses on a neuron could become weaker simultaneously. And this is a really interesting phenomenon, but we really didn't understand when neurons would actually do this in a living animal. And so my work tried to link this phenomenon that we'd seen in the dish with some idea that scaling down might happen during sleep. And the idea here is that synapses become stronger the longer we're awake as we encode information from our lives, and that during sleep, these synapses become weaker, resetting the synapses back to some basal level. And this will allow for a greater range of new synapse strengthening when we wake up, which would enable new learning. And part of the idea here also is that a lot of the information that we encode during the day actually does not get consolidated into long-term memory. It's trivial things like, what did I have for breakfast? Where did I park my car? And these things we remember for a few hours, but actually might become eliminated during sleep, perhaps freeing up space for important memories.
Marcos Frank.
Well, I'll begin by taking a slightly contrarian position to what Graham said. And that is that I think that while there is evidence that sleep plays an important role or important role in some types of learning and memory, I believe that the function of sleep is actually going to involve something more basic and simple about neurons, and that the effects that we see in learning and memory are an outcome of this more fundamental thing that sleep is doing that we haven't discovered yet. So while it's true that there is evidence for weakening of synapses in sleep, as Graham has said, there's also considerable evidence that depending on the kinds of experiences that precede sleep, synapses can also get stronger or more synapses may form. So I believe where we are right now in the field is that, and particularly thanks to work from Graham, is that we're beginning to apply these really elegant tools that have been used in other areas of neuroscience to this age-old problem about sleep function. And we're beginning to understand at least some of the things that are going on one side of the story, but there's other things that are going on too. So I don't think the story is as simple as sleep is only doing these things for learning and memory. There could be other more basic functions that are being served.
So Marcos Frank, one of the things I read in relation to your work was you talking about one of the complications of even studying this phenomenon because there are so many different stages of sleep and they might mean different things. Can you talk us through some of that?
Well, one of the big problems in the field, and it's been in the field since its inception in the modern investigations of sleep, it's very difficult to disentangle other things that occur across the 24-hour day. with sleep and wakefulness. So we already know that there are biological clocks in the brain and the body, and they produce rhythms in a variety of things, including things that happen in neurons that occur coincident with wake and sleep, but are independent of wake and sleep. So in many cases, if the design of the experiment's not careful enough, it's almost impossible to dissociate the effects of clocks from sleep and wake. So that's a major problem. The other problem is, as you pointed out, is that sleep is not a single brain state. In mammals, it's comprised of at least two different states. Most of the work that we've been discussing has focused on non-rapid eye movement sleep. But in mammals such as ourselves, rapid eye movement sleep comprises quite a bit of the sleep cycle. So we have a whole chunk of sleep that may be doing different things, and we can't look at one state and then assume the second state is doing exactly the same thing. So, and it's very hard to tease this apart.
Let's get a response. Graham Deering, what do you say to that?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with just about everything Marco said. And indeed, it's a complex problem. One thing I'll add to the last point, differences between slow non-REM sleep and REM sleep are rapid eye movement sleep. Indeed, humans have quite a bit of this REM sleep, and also this breakdown of non-REM and REM changes also throughout development. So it's quite possible that the functions of sleep might also be regulated during development. That's also something that's quite an unknown area. And let me go back also to the purpose of sleep. So I started off by talking about learning and memory. I think it's fair to say that sleep is very important for learning and memory. But if we look back in evolution, we can see clearly that sleep's a conserved behavior that goes back basically to all animals. And we can look at an animal like nematode worms or fruit flies, where learning and memory maybe is not that important for their survival. And yet they show sleep-like behaviors, perhaps even in the jellyfish. So I think the function of sleep probably is some very fundamental ancient function. And during evolution, additional functions may have been added on to this sleep behavior.
And some animals sleep for much longer at certain periods of the global cycle, it seems, you know, with hibernation and that sort of a thing. Can we make sense of it that way?
Well, I think that's sort of speaking to the point that I was sort of just trying to bring up, that sleep might be, you could almost imagine it's a Swiss Army knife that has been added to continually over evolution. It's a very good time to be doing different kind of maintenance of body system, the brain system. There might be some special metabolic things that happen during sleep. And I think that the specific aspects of learning and memory might have been sort of one of the more recent additions. Hibernation probably has a completely different type of ecological need. It's a kind of sleep-like state, but it's been adapted for some specific ecological, niches.
So when we talked about the different stages of sleep, and we know there's the REM and the non-REM, right? And I understand there's sort of a light and a deep. Is one more important than the other in human brain function? Do we know this, Marcos Frank?
Short answer is no, we don't. And I think Graham would agree with me that when it comes to sleep, despite all the advances we've made, and I say we collectively, scientists, in literally the last 100 years, we don't have an answer to that basic question. When it comes to learning and memory, there's great debates over the relative roles of non-rapid eye movement or non-REM sleep and REM sleep in these processes. Some argue that REM sleep's important for this kind of memory consolidation, but other people find other findings and suggest that no, it's not. It's actually important for that kind of memory consolidation. And this debate, by the way, has been going on at least for 50 years. So since the discovery of REM sleep back in 1953, both jointly here in the United States and also in France, there has been a huge attention to rapid eye movement sleep and this idea that it's involved with dreaming, for example, which we know is not exactly true anymore. And because of that, there's been a huge interest in REM sleep and higher cognitive function in the brain. But the reality is that we still don't really know what REM sleep is doing relative to non-REM sleep. And in terms of restorative sleep, well, there's some evidence. When I say restorative, this is a whole other mystery. We don't know exactly what's being restored in the brain that makes you feel better in the morning after a good night of sleep. But in terms of restorative sleep, there is a little bit better evidence that non-REM sleep seems to be more restorative than REM. But again, there's no consensus in the field, in my opinion.
There does seem to be some evidence that sleep is vital for immune system function. Is that something that has enough evidence for us to say, yeah, that's like gravity, we know it's true?
No, in my opinion. So like with many things with sleep, there's a lot of tantalizing clues. And I think what Graham said is very important, this idea that when we look at sleep in animals such as ourselves, we're really looking at many, many things that have happened over the course of millions of years of evolution. So there may be some animal species in which there is clear connections between immune function and sleep, but it's not universally found in other species, not even within mammals, not even within primates, turns out. So while there may be some evidence in humans that immune function can be affected in different ways with sleep and sleep loss, it's not the same for other primates that have been studied, and it's not the same uniformly through rodents. So there's, unfortunately, I can't give you a simple answer to immune function and sleep. There's clearly some kind of connection. It may also reflect the fact that molecules that are involved in our immune function in the body, they have second roles inside the central nervous system that are independent in many cases of their immune function. So that's another complication, is that when we talk about immune system and sleep, what we're really talking about is immune molecules and sleep. And they may not be doing exactly the same thing inside the brain as they're doing outside the inside in the rest of the body.
Graham Deering.
Yeah, I'll continue where Marcos left off. I think it makes a lot of sense that when you are challenged with some infection or something like that, you have inflammation in the body, and it might be that sleeping can help accelerate the recovery from this infection. And so this immune system is activated, and it might actually, some of those molecules that are fighting infection in the body might actually signal to the brain that we should increase the amount of sleep. And so it's pretty typical that when you have a cold or a flu, you feel groggy and tired. And this might be part of the way that we recover. And this sort of reverse of that, how does loss of sleep affect the immune system? It's a really difficult question to answer, partly because loss of sleep is a real stress to the body. And it might be that loss of sleep secondarily causes immune changes through this stress.
Isn't it also true generally that loss of sleep, if it's continuous, also correlates with loss of memory? So then that would bring back the learning question. Graham Deering.
Yeah, I think it's clear that a great night's sleep does wonders for memory formation, and loss of sleep is disastrous. I don't know how much more I can add to that. We all know from our own experiences how slow our brain seems to work after a night without sleep or poor sleep.
Are the human meta studies enough to conclude at least a relationship there? It looks like a causal relationship. Marcos Frank?
God, I'm going to be the bad guy here.
That's all right. We like bad guys.
I agree that there's probably a greater number of studies that have shown supportive evidence for the idea that sleep is important for some forms of memory formation. But again, I point out to the fact that it's really difficult to really draw a conclusion. And so you can have, let's say, a preponderance of studies that all point the same direction, but if each one is confounded by a design problem, then each one is not very, adds very little to the story. Now, there's a handful of studies, I do think, where the controls have been very good, and including for controls for biological clocks, and there still is a positive effect of sleep on some kinds of learning and memory. So I do believe that overall the evidence is pointing towards that this is certainly an outcome of whatever the function of sleep might be, that it has something to do with how the brain processes information. And this is something that's conserved also, to pick up a point that Graham was talking about, across species. All the things we've discussed to date, or right now I should say, regarding possible sleep function, whether it's immune function or something about the body, that's true for some species, but not others. But there's one thing that you always find to be true with sleep and sleep loss, that it has an impact on the brain's ability to process information. So that tells me that something fundamental about how neurons operate is still at the heart of what sleep is for. So yeah, it's a long way of answering your question, I guess, but I would say that our best theories right now concern the role of sleep in higher order function like learning and memory.
What is a glia cell?
So most of us are familiar with neurons. These are cells in the brain that are excitable electrically. And for the last 150 years or more, most of what we thought about how the brain operates has been through these excitable cells. But it turns out that there's more than two-thirds of the cells in the brain are glial cells, which are not excitable in the sense that neurons are. They were originally thought to be glue. The Greek word glia refers to glue, that it would hold things together in the brain. And they didn't seem to be that interesting to neuroscientists. And I think that's in part because we didn't have the tools to measure what they do. When all you have is an electrode and you measure electrical activity, you have a cell that doesn't give you anything when you poke it, then you move on to one that does. And that's kind of what's happened in the history of glial cells. In the last 25 years, our view about glial cells has changed quite dramatically. We now know that they can be partners in very complex things that the brain does, including perhaps plasticity in the brain, development of the brain for sure. And now increasingly there's some evidence that they might be important in sleep.
So they might be important in sleep, but you don't really know how.
We have some ideas. So one of the things that has been shown is that different classes of glia can, they do different things in the brain. So some of them act as the brain's immune system. Some of them are positioned to sample from the activity of many hundreds of connections between neurons at the same time. They're also positioned to sample the blood and tell what the energy levels are. They can filter things in the brain and maybe clean out various metabolic byproducts of wakefulness. So they're well positioned to do lots of important things that have been assumed to be what sleep is doing in the brain. So there's some evidence now that in fact that may be true. So we can do things to glial cells in animal models and then measure what happens to sleep and wakefulness. And when we do that, we find that if you alter certain glial signaling pathways or glial biological functions, that actually changes how animals respond to sleep loss. Other studies have shown that glia seem to be part of a cleaning system of the brain, that they can actually filter out a lot of these metabolic byproducts. This is probably one of the major findings in the last 5 years, maybe 10 years with respect, certainly with respect to glia and sleep. But we've just really begun to explore this in detail, even though the idea that glia were involved in sleep goes back to Ramon y Cajal. So we're talking about someone that worked on one of the great, great giants of the field of neuroscience back more than 100 years ago, who was looking at these cells in the stained sections of tissue that he had at the time, drawing beautiful pictures of these cells and then imagining what they could be doing. And at that time, he proposed that they could be involved in sleep and wake. It's turning out to be right.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing mysteries of our slumber. Why do we sleep? What is its purpose? And what actually happens during sleep? So, Graham Deering, how does this connect back to what we were talking about with your research?
Right. So I think we're building up a picture that there isn't really one function of sleep. It's a time that's developed over evolution to incorporate multiple functions. And I think my work focusing on synaptic plasticity and changes of synapses is really more specific to learning and memory. How do we renew the ability to learn every day? And I love the work on the glia changes between wake and sleep. And I see that the role of the glia during sleep as a separate function of sleep, part of the maintenance of the organ, the health of the brain, maintaining the health of the brain rather than specifically for informational reasons. So I see these as parallel functions. The glia are undergoing certain processes during sleep to renew the health of the brain, and the neurons are adapting their synapses to renew their capacity for learning.
So there were a couple things I saw in your work as well, including a new protein that was discovered. What is that?
So this protein, Homer 1A, I think it's a really interesting molecule. The work here in sleep was directly inspired from this phenomenon of homeostatic scaling down, which has been observed in cultured neurons. And so it was shown previously that this protein Homer 1A was critical for this scaling down in cultured neurons. And another thing with this protein, HOMER1A, is that it's strongly expressed in neurons that are that have been activated during some kind of learning process. And so what this molecule is able to do then is to link learning, gene expression during learning while we're awake, with then a restorative process during sleep. And the way I see this working is that when you are actively learning something new, the neurons that are the most engaged in this learning will express HOMER1A, and then, which results also in strengthening of those synapses in those neurons. And then when you go to sleep, the HOMER1A that was expressed while we were awake can now start this renewal process, a restorative process of scaling down, so that those neurons that were strengthened during wake can now have a chance to recover during sleep.
I found it quite fascinating that even in lab dishes, these neurons were behaving in a sleeping and waking kind of fashion. It sounds like there is at least this kind of cycle, even on the most fundamental level.
Yeah, I think that's right. And actually, I'd like to tie this into one of the previous points that we were making. So neurons in a dish can do this phenomenon of homeostatic scaling, scaling up and scaling down. And it turns out in the dish, if you just have pure neurons, it's actually very slow. It takes up to 48 hours to see this, the full effect of this scaling process. Whereas what I would propose during sleep, this could happen in a few hours. And I think that in the brain, there's a lot more intimate communication between the glial cells and the neurons. And this might actually help the neurons to accelerate this process within a few hours.
Here, here.
And so I guess finally what I'd want to do is kind of connect this to the, how does this affect me, right? Why can't I sleep? How is this affecting me? What does this mean for my, you know, well-being and my health and my mental health and my functional? And am I going to be able to teach my classes regularly, et cetera, et cetera? Can we respond to this in any kind of a way from what you guys have been studying, Marcos, Frank?
Well, the good news is that even without Graham and myself doing basic science in the brain, scientists have moved on anyway to find ways to understand the timing of sleep, when to go to sleep, we call sleep hygiene, all these things that can make you have better sleep and then perform better the next day. And it's kind of interesting. This is one of these rare situations where there's all these sorts of therapies and things you can do, even though we don't understand the basic process going on in the brain. It's sort of like if I told you something to eat or drink differently, but I had no idea what the stomach or intestines did. That's kind of where we are in my mind still with sleep. So I think everything that Graham has shown, for example, in this very, very important study, and the other kinds of works that have come out in the last 25 years, reinforce the idea that making sure that you have the amount of sleep that's right for you. And by the way, although we always talk about 8 hours is the amount you need, it varies tremendously from person to person. And as silly as it may sound, the best indicator of how much sleep you should get each person is how much sleep you need to feel better the next day. I mean, that's how the divide is between neuroscientists like Graham and myself and clinicians that actually advise people about how to get better sleep. But there are ways to improve your sleep, even though we don't know why you're sleeping.
You know, both studies made me question, you know, these sleep aids that people use and whether or not they actually help you get that restorative sleep or whether they disrupt it. Do we know anything about that?
Well, I'll start a little bit is that I think actually there's been an explosion, and Graham's, you know, younger than I am, so he's more connected to these things probably than I am, but there's a whole bunch of things that have popped up in the market right now, and all these apps to record your sleep states or your brain waves and all these other things. And I don't think a lot of them have been really well tested. So there's a lot of noise out there about what's good to use and help you sleep. I think the simplest thing is, or for example, just simple activity measures are informative for people. So if you find by wearing a device that tells you how active you've been during the day, you'll find pretty quickly whether you've not been sleeping through the night, and maybe that's contributing to things that you're doing. So I think the technology explosion with apps and so forth, it's potentially a good thing, but very few of them have been really vetted in a way that would satisfy Graham and myself.
And what about medications? Do they make a difference? Do they make things worse? Do it make things better?
Well, I'll say one thing, and I'll let Graham weigh in on this, but right now there is no pill that can be given to you that produces what we would call physiological sleep. That is sleep that is as normal and as natural as you would have without a medication, without having a problem already with insomnia or something like that. This has been the holy grail for pharmaceutical companies because insomnia is so common in industrialized countries, and yet we still don't have one. So the drugs that are available now have improved from where they used to be, where they used to be very heavy narcotic-like drugs, but they're still not producing physiological sleep. They still have a lot of problems. They do not produce the normal sleep cycles or the same kind of brain waves that you see during normal sleep. In some cases, these drugs can impair the processes that are important in learning and memory. Now, we don't know if they impair them because they're affecting the processes Graham talked about. I think that's an interesting question. Hopefully Graham can look at that. But there are clear evidence that a lot of the sleep drugs that are available can prevent memory formation. So we don't have the solution right now in the pill.
Graham Deering?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for improvement in the medicines used to treat sleep. I don't want to say too much for fear of pharmaceutical companies banging my door down. But it is a holy grail, as Marco said. And if I were to design a sleep drug, I would want to know what are all the on and off buttons that control sleep, and what are the restorative parts of sleep that allow us to think clearly. And I would design drugs to target those processes. But the sleep aid drugs that are used today basically were not designed with any of this information. You can almost think of them, the sleep aid properties of those drugs, it's almost a side effect of those drugs discovered pretty much by accident. And most of the sleep aid drugs that are out there basically work by suppressing the activity of the brain, causing drowsiness, but they don't really target the real processes of sleep, and especially not the restorative parts of sleep.
Earlier, we were all talking about the evolutionary process and its relationship to sleep. And I can recall an article that suggested if we went back far enough into human history, the patterns of sleeping were quite different. They may have been 4 hours, 2 hours awake, 4 hours of sleep, something more like that. And that perhaps what we've done is made an unnatural shift to this, where you have to sleep, you know, a straight 7 or 8 hours. Is there any evidence to this, or is this speculation?
I'll chip in first a little bit because I reviewed a couple of grants recently on this topic. So there is evidence. So let me back up and say that the current story is that modern man lives in this completely artificial environment in which our species evolved, that we, you know, woke and slept with the rise and fall of the sun. And what we have now is, as you said, this very artificial lighting conditions in which that we are trying to impose our activity rhythms against what nature actually gave us many millions of years ago. The evidence that this could be true comes from a few studies of what are, I guess we would call, non-industrialized societies or tribes, where there have been some studies looking at the sleep behaviors of populations, let's say in the jungles in Africa and South America. And these are people that had not been exposed to these sort of industrialized, I can't say for sure that they've never been touched by the industrialized world, but in some senses they have not been touched. When you look at their sleep-wake patterns, they are different to some extent from what we see, but not radically different than what we see in our societies. Now, having said that, these findings are controversial. It's not settled science by any means. So it's an open question. And there has been also people that have argued that there was a time, even in Europe, in the medieval period, where we had something that was called mid-wake, where individuals would wake up in the middle, and it was common, you know, wake up around 3 a.m, 2 a.m, and have a whole active period and then go back to sleep. Again, without the industrial lighting that we have today. But whether that's really true or not is It's been belied by the findings in these more non-industrialized societies. They seem to sleep through the night, and they sleep about the same amount that we do, even in the United States or New Zealand. That's an open question.
Graham Deering.
Well, just over Christmas, I was visiting my family in Canada, and this time of year, it's pretty dark. The sun was only coming up around 8 o'clock. And I was sleeping heroic 9-10 hours. and I basically only felt like waking up when the sun coming up. So I think we can congratulate ourselves on all kinds of industrial innovations, but nothing is more influential for our habits than the sun, I think. And so sleeping at night, I'm pretty sure, goes back to the earliest humans.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your research with us.
Thank you
very much.
Marcos Frank is professor and chair at the Department of Biomedical Sciences at Washington State University, Spokane. He's the author of The Mystery of Sleep Function, The Role of Sleep in Memory Consolidation and Brain Plasticity, Dream or Reality. Graham Deering is a professor of cell biology and physiology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the co-author of Homer 1A drives homeostatic scaling down of excitatory synapses during sleep. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.